Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update Call. Hancock Horizon Investments provides this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions that you would like addressed on the call, please email David Lundgren at david_lundgren@hancockhorizon.com. On today's call, we have David Lundgren, Chief Investment Officer, who will serve as a moderator. We have John Portwood, Chief Investment Strategist, and Investment Directors Greg Hedleski, Jeffrey Tangus, and Richard Chauvin. With that, I'll pass the call to David Lundgren.
Great. Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to this month's edition of our Market and Economic Update Call. And John Portwood, we'll start with you. We're about 3 weeks away from the end of the quarter. So if you could, give us a little bit of an update on how things are shaping up. We've had three quarters in a row right around 1% heading into the third quarter. Do you see some improvement over where we've been?
Yeah, I think we talked about this in last month's meeting. We were seeing some indications that early in the quarter, this GDP number, the one that's coming up the third quarter, would probably be better than any we had seen all year. That still seems to be the case when you look at the coincident economic indicators, particularly one from the Atlanta Fed that's supposed to measure GDP now. That one's hanging in pretty close to 3%. So there's a pretty wide range of error there in what that suggests, but it does indicate that this might be a pretty decent quarter. We've talked in the past about the fact that we're in a relatively low trend growth environment compared to what we've seen in recent years. We've been in a low trend growth environment now since 2008, but certainly compared to what we saw in the last century, something before 2000. That's not likely to change. While we are in an economic environment that still seems to be okay, and the leading indicators, while weak, don't suggest we're on the verge of recession, there are things going on that don't normally go hand in hand with a relatively positive economy, and I'll mention a few. Restaurant sales, for example, are weak. Restaurants generally are experiencing low volume. There appears to be a movement to eat at home because it's cheaper. You're also seeing retail sales generally stay in a relatively tepid mode. More recently, some retail sales came out, and if you looked at the latest report of the control group is like the core of the core retail sales. That number was around 2%. It rarely goes negative except in great recessions like 2008. But at 2%, that number is associated in the past with recessionary conditions or early recessionary conditions. At the same time, we see these numbers certainly contribute to the coincident index number, but they don't control it. We're seeing a break in luxury real estate around the world, and from Singapore all the way to Aspen, Colorado. Anywhere you've had a run-up in luxury real estate, you're seeing that bubble burst and burst fairly strongly. New York, San Francisco, London. That obviously reflects something going on globally that is bound to have some kind of impact on our economy. So while things look okay here at home, there are things going on around the world that are not all that attractive. One thing to keep in mind, too, is that the central bank push from using monetary policy alone appears to be having more negative results now rather than positive. And we've talked about a lot of that in the past. I saw a number this morning that suggested 40%, central bank balance sheets in the developed world probably represent now about 40% of GDP. And along with that is the story that the Swiss central bank owns more shares of Facebook than Mark Zuckerberg, who's the chief executive officer of the company. That gives you an idea of what kind of monetary manipulation is going on out there. And the G20, the group of 20 nations, just had a meeting in China. The only thing that came out of that I guess we need to really pay attention to is the fact that the draft indicated that global leaders should make full use of a range of policy options, including fiscal as well as monetary measures, to revive economic growth that still falls short of desired levels. So the picture I just gave you of central banks' balance sheets representing about 40% of GDP, you begin to wonder if that's a preview of things to come and perhaps even more radical monetary policies to juice growth worldwide. So while we tend to be doing reasonably well here, again, growth around the world seems to be relatively slow. So odds are we're not in a situation where a pickup in one quarter suggests that we're about to embark on a sustainable growth rate at a higher level. So we're still probably in that 2% trend. But again, the good news is that we're not on the verge of a recession, at least not yet. We'll have one at some point, of course, but probably not yet.
Don, you mentioned troubles around the globe, and I guess it's been about 2 months or so since the Brexit vote. Any impact that we can see from that at this point? And I guess the other question I'd like you to address is there seem to be building anti-globalization sentiment. Has that was it the Brexit sort of a one-time event, or do you still see that trend building across the globe?
No, it seems like that trend is still in place. Recently, the Germans and the French made some negative noises about a transatlantic trade agreement that we've been working on for some time. Basically, they said we don't like it and it gives too much of an advantage to the United States, and we're not going to vote for it. That needs to be rearranged. And you probably also think a lot of us have read previous stories about this Trans-Pacific trade agreement that is something similar on the Pacific side of the United States, and that appears to be also in trouble. One thing that all of these agreements tend to have that is not viewed in a positive light in this anti-globalized environment, I guess you might you'd say, is the fact that bureaucracies are involved in making the decisions for the countries and the nations rather than the nations themselves. It's kind of like Eurozone light. If you engage in, if you create this transatlantic trade partnership and you do the same thing on the Pacific side, then you've got a bureaucracy made up of members of the countries involved that will make decisions on trade agreements rather than the nations themselves being able to come in and make some alterations themselves. So in this kind of environment where people are thinking more nationalistically and less globally, that sort of thing is not going to fly. And to the extent, of course, that slows down global trade, it could make things a little bit worse than they are. And currently, global trade is slow. You can measure that very well by looking at China. And exports from China are down because the West is not buying as much from them as used to be the case. And imports to China are down. It's a pretty good way to measure what's happening to growth globally, which is still positive, but it's moving at a relatively slow pace, and there's not much chance that that's going to change anytime soon.
Okay. Thank you, John. Jeff Tangus, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
For those of you that aren't frequent callers or listeners, to our monthly call, Jeff is director of fixed income and is based in Baton Rouge. And Jeff, obviously Baton Rouge has been going through an incredibly difficult time over the last month or so, and don't by any means want to make light of the human aspect of the disaster and flooding that occurred there. But this is an economic call, so we wanted to talk a little bit about the potential economic impact of the disaster there in Baton Rouge, the flood. Can you talk a little bit about how that might impact the Louisiana economy?
Well, I'd be happy to, Dave. It is a big deal. The word is finally getting out. At first, it seemed like most of the country just ignored the problem. It wasn't largely reported in the national media. We've gotten more attention, and certainly we had President Obama come down. That helped draw some attention, and we've gotten a very good federal response to the flooding. Originally, four parishes were designated disaster areas, and for those of us who were down here and lived in the area, we sort of just raised an eyebrow at that because we knew that the devastation was a lot more widespread. Well, essentially that's been expanded to 20 parishes now, but with four or five really being the hardest hit. And so it's a disaster that is in a lot of ways a Katrina on a much smaller scale. The number that I throw out is 60,000 housing units seems to be a pretty reliable number now. They're still trying to add it up, but about 60,000 housing units in this four or five parish area were heavily impacted by flooding. And again, remember, this is a 1,000-year rain event, probably a 500-year flood event. So with that background, it was a big deal. So the economics of that are always a concern. We grow up with disasters of various sorts, hurricanes, floods in the South here. So there's a lot of experience that we can draw on. Essentially, the way these things work is, and actually I got this from the Louisiana State Treasurer, John Kennedy. He was talking about how the state finances work. Initially, of course, it's a big positive. Everything stops. All commerce stops. People are dispersed. Retail centers are flooded. People can't get in. Not much happens. So it's a big negative from a cash flow standpoint for the local parishes, somewhat for the state, but the state isn't nearly as impacted as the local parishes. And the parishes here are East Baton Rouge, Livingston, which is Denham Springs, Ascension Parish, which is Gonzales, also Tangipahoa Parish, well, Helena, St. Helena, Tangipahoa were also heavily impacted. And so those are the primary areas. The heavily populated areas, being Denham Springs and Ascension Parish as satellites of the East Baton Rouge area and East and West Feliciano to the north, they have more people, so it has much more of an economic impact. Essentially, though, the credit agencies have said it's always a credit negative when you have a flooding event. They don't have any... right now, they don't have any particular downgrade. They haven't put us on notice for any particular downgrade. The state has a rainy day fund. The state has to pick up about 25% of the cost. FEMA picks up about 75% of the state-funded cost, the state things that have to be done, like picking up trash and repairing public buildings and of that sort. People's homes, that's a whole different story because of the fact that this was such a 1,000-year rain event that a large number of people did not have flood insurance. You get limited FEMA resources in that event, and so it's very different than typical, but in that sense. But the after the initial session where everything stops, and then you get to the rebuilding stage, which of course tax receipts will rise dramatically. The state just raised state sales taxes to 10% because of some budget deficits before the flood. So they'll reap huge benefits there. So actually, it'll be a kind of a medium-term positive as we go through the next 6 months of the primary rebuilding process. And then once you get past that, things kind of return to normal. It will have cost us some money, but probably at the end of the day, with the FEMA money in the equation, and the fact that the state has a rainy day fund that can handle a lot of these extraordinary, unusual expenses. From an economic and municipal bond financial standpoint, we don't expect any significant changes in credit quality. The really long-term outlook, though, is really what happens in these places that never flooded before, what happens to property values there, and it's really too early. But in terms of the foreseeable future, let's look out about the next 12 months. It won't be a material event from a positive or a negative point, at least as it stands right now.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. During the month of August, towards the end of the month, they had the annual economic conference in Jackson Hole. It's an event where a lot of market participants look forward to hearing what the Fed Reserve Chairman Janet Yellen had to say, and wanted to see if you had any thoughts regarding her comments and any change as a result of her comments on the outlook for interest rates.
Well, to quote one of our presidential candidates, there was a lot of smoke but no fire coming out of Jackson Hole. As usual, it was a lot of rhetoric. You had central bankers from around the world there in addition to Janet Yellen. The central bankers in Europe and Japan, Asia, they are all still, as John Portwood mentioned, they are all still working towards lowering interest rates while our central bank, Janet Yellen, is working on raising interest rates. The upshot of it was nothing really material came out of it. People thought maybe the Fed was being a little bit more hawkish, a little bit more aggressive. We had a weak employment number last week, which took a lot of the enthusiasm for that viewpoint, which sort of brings us back to what we've been saying all along, is that the Fed probably raises in December because they really do want to raise, but they don't feel like they should raise or could raise right now. Probably the most noteworthy thing that came out of Jackson Hole and the central bank retreat was you're really hearing a lot more of what I would call the crazy talk that Portwood references sometimes, called helicopter money. Central banks talking about essentially printing money and using it for stimulus programs on a massive scale, a shocking scale, such that countries or consumers like ourselves can't ignore it. We have to think inflation is coming. That's the problem they have now. No matter what they do, they can't get the fear of inflation up, which is kind of odd since we spent 30 years trying to fight the idea of higher inflation. So it was, as I say, it was a lot of talk. Nothing really significant policy-wise came out of it other than you are hearing more and more talk out of the European and Asian economies about doing something even more aggressive and sometimes even bordering on a little bit of craziness.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jeff. Greg Kodleski, good morning.
Good morning.
Again, for those of you that aren't frequent listeners, Greg is our director of equity. So obviously, we'll like to talk about stocks this morning, Greg. And August was, at least in the large cap space, it was flat. Not much change during the course of the month, not much volatility. A little bit better month for small cap stocks. The Russell 2000 was up 1.8%. International stocks slightly positive at 0.7%. Give us your thoughts on the month.
Well, as you said, it was kind of a flat month. And I think last month's call, we kind of talked about August being historically kind of a very uneventful month. And as you said, the Dow Jones was up 0.3%, the S&P 500 up 0.1%. Again, mid-caps and small-caps were the better-performing areas, with mid-caps up about 0.5%, and small caps actually turning in a pretty strong, as measured by the S&P 600, up 1.4%. International, again, developed markets in the international, that's our, their equivalent of our large cap stocks, were up only 0.05%, so not much going on there. But the other international areas were a little bit better. Looking at the emerging markets, were up 2.65%. Asia by far was the best performing area of the global stock markets. It was up 4%. So there are some bright spots, and probably a lot of that had to do with some of the Brexit and monetary easing that are going around globally that others have touched on already during this call. So for the most part, it'll be interesting to see what this month holds. And I think probably what we're going to see going forward would be that there's going to be a lot of sector rotation. And we'll touch on the best performing sectors here in a little bit. But I think as the polls kind of sway back and forth, Hillary versus Trump, I think the Wall Street is going to be jumping in and out of different sectors as one takes the lead in the polls and probably trying to guess, you know, what the best area will be. Financials and technology were the leaders in the large cap area, while energy shined in the mid and small caps. Best performing areas were energy for the month were up 1.2%. Financials were up 3.8%. Industrials were up 0.8%, and technology was up 2%, leading to the downside, which is kind of contrary to what we've seen year-to-date. Telecom and utilities were actually down almost 6% each, respectively. Yet, if you look at the year-to-date numbers, telecom is up 18.96%, and utilities up 15.67%. So that trend that we've seen where people are chasing yields, dividend yield continues, but it's been giving up a little bit of ground. Looking at the mid-cap space, right now the energy was up 3.3%, financials up 0.8%, we saw industrials up 1.7%, and technology up 3.3%. The big losers again were also telecom and utilities, with telecom in the mid-cap area down almost 12%, and utilities down nearly 5%. So those were also weak areas. And then moving on to small caps, we saw for the month energy up almost 9%, financials up 3.5%, industrials up almost 3%, materials up almost 3%, and technology up almost 4%. And again, the biggest areas that were hard hit, telecom was down 12.6%, and utilities down 5.25%. So I think, again, we're going to see a lot of rotation in sectors. It's going to be probably volatile. We haven't seen an uptick in volatility yet, and I don't think the election probably means a whole lot to the overall stock market, but I think it will drive the way things are invested and the way things are moved around on the chessboard, if you want to use an analogy. So we'll see what happens.
Thank you, Greg. Let's move on to Richard. And again, Richard Chauvin, one of our investment directors, and Richard focuses on asset allocation and due diligence for our firm. And Richard, one thing that I've heard you speak a lot about lately, it really ties in nicely to some of Greg's comments. We've had this incredible year for any type of yielding security or alternative source of yield, whether it be REITs or utility stocks or telecom. And we started to see in the month of August that turn a little bit. Talk a little bit about the trend that's occurred this year, and give us your thoughts on whether, you know, a bubble had formed there and we're in the early stages of that bubble bursting, or as Greg mentioned, you know, we'll just continue to see further rotation in and out of these types of instruments.
Thank you, Dave, and good morning, everyone. I think this is a very interesting topic to us as well as to, I think, many listeners. So the question that I'm posing here is there a bubble that's developed in this group of stocks? I'm going to refer to it as the low volatility group. It's largely synonymous with the high dividend yield stocks. They're basically a large overlap, but I'm going to focus on the subset of the S&P 500 index that's called the low volatility index. It's represented by 100 stocks that are low volatility, which means they obviously don't vary in price, and they also tend to have above average dividend yields. So the one way you can look at this group is to first just look at the performance that's developed here, and I'm going to look year to date, and I'm going to look further back as well to see how this trend has developed. Just a couple of general numbers here. On a year-to-date basis, even after the pullback that Greg mentioned in August, this low-vol group of stocks is up about 3% more than the S&P 500 on a year-to-date basis. It was up 10.57% year-to-date. Pretty nice performance if you can get it. On a one-year basis, it's 6% ahead, over 6% of the S&P 500, up almost 19% year-to-year, August to August. On a two-year basis, it's even more dramatic. This group is 12% ahead of the S&P 500 over the last 2 years, up approximately 25% in price, or I should say in total return, over that two-year period. So obviously a great place to have invested over that time. So again, the question, is this a bubble? One way to evaluate that is to look at the valuation of these stocks. And we often do that by looking at the price earnings ratio, or PE ratio for short. The group has been trading at 22 times earnings. That compares to a long-term average. We've actually measured over the last 44 years. That long-term average is about 13 times earnings, so it's obviously well ahead of that. And statistically, for those of you who follow statistical analysis, it's about 2 standard deviations above the long-term average, which basically means there's about a 2% chance that the valuation would ever get this high. So it's way out of the norm in terms of valuation. How does this compare to previous bubbles that we know to have existed? The most comparable one in terms of level of overvaluation was the 1929 period prior to the Great Depression. It was also trading over two standard deviations above its mean. More recent bubbles occurred, such as the Japanese market in 1989, which got much more extended. It was 64 times earnings. And then the NASDAQ bubble in 2000, which all of us remember, was trading at 49 times earnings, or almost 5 standard deviations above the mean. So we're certainly not at those kind of levels. The most comparable bubble to compare this to is probably the Nifty 50 in the early 1970s. Some of us can remember that period as one where investors were looking for a safe haven within the stock market among companies that they felt like had such strong business prospects that they piled into these stocks due to their perceived safety, due to their status as a strong business. They traded at about 38 times earnings back in 1972. They also made up about 40% of the S&P 500, so they covered a lot of the index. Today's low-vol index only represents about 20% of the S&P 500. So the reason I mention that is to say that whatever risk exists in these stocks probably doesn't have as big of an impact on the overall market as those earlier bubbles did, but that's not to say that they don't represent risk. We do believe that given their valuation, if you're in these types of stocks, you should not consider them safe havens anymore. They are representing some risk of price decline once this trend reverses. So the last question I'll ask and try to address is what's going to happen to these stocks over the long run? Well, we believe they will revert toward their mean at some point, but what the catalyst might be is still pretty much in question. More than likely, a jump in interest rates that's unanticipated will probably be a catalyst that we see developing at some point in the future. And we're not talking about just an increase in the Fed funds rate that might be caused by Fed policy, as Jeff talked about. That probably would not be enough to do it. It's probably going to require a jump in interest rate that involves, you know, Treasury rates over the 5- and 10-year maturity ranges, corporate bonds, municipal bonds, things that really reset the overall interest rate environment would be detrimental to these stocks. And what might cause that would probably be an unexpected jump in inflation. Again, inflation doesn't seem to be a risk that people are concerned about at the moment. And you can look at the bond market and say there is no price compensation for inflation at all today, so investors aren't concerned about it. So there's probably a good source of where the risk could develop. Again, timing is unknown, and that is the big question. We do see risk in these stocks. We don't see an apparent intermediate or near-term risk, but it's something that we're cautious about and are aware of, and we think the listeners should be as well. Those are my comments, Dave.
Great. Thank you very much, Richard. Interesting stuff. It's a little bit after 9:30. We'll go ahead and end the call now. And thank you, everyone, for joining, and hopefully you can join us again next month. Our call will be on October 4th. Thank you.